You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
What question was she at when all this happened? Let's talk about your book. Let's talk about when you know, how you decided to write the book. And really explain to the audience the journey and what really was the impetus for finally writing this extraordinary story.
So I open up the book with a story about my family walking one night. And we were walking because we had just been evicted from living underneath and around Grand Central. I was born into homelessness. There was no before time. My mom and two siblings, we had no before. It was simply surviving day to day on the streets of New York City in the early 80s. And that was my 12 years of my life. The book opens, though, just a moment before it opens, there's another part of the story which is not there, which is we had been cleaned up. We had been evicted out of that space. And that was pretty typical at the time. They were arresting their way out of this issue, which thankfully we're not doing today. My family was forced out on the streets that night, and we started wandering. And we wandered to the point where we almost died from exposure. And that's the story I tell in the book to open up this story. And the reason I shared that story in particular and answer your question why I wrote the book is there's 8.4 million children living in abject poverty today. There are 1 in 4 kids are hungry in this country. What are their parents eating? We have the solution. We know what we can do. We can choose not to live like this. And I wanted to use my story to motivate people to go from empathy to action. And I think that's completely what the mayor was saying. We can make a different choice in this society. And that's what I want us to do. And I had to come out as a formerly homeless person to motivate people to look at us as people, not as an it, to be cleaned up. And so I wanted to do that from a bucket of privilege that I have and use my platform and my privilege to tell a story which is not spoken enough from this lens, from this place. And I wanted to do it also to release this, a lot of stories in there that my family and friends did not know. Some of them are here today. And I wanted it just to come all out and come clean at once.
Could you read the quotation?
Oh,
I memorized the book.
The
you
opening
probably
one?
Memorized it.
Oh.
Would you read it?
Absolutely. The one
quotation,
line.
Quotation, yeah. I observed this exchange. This.
Oh.
You described two different. Okay, this, the quotation.
You read the quote. I'll tell you about it.
Okay.
I don't remember that quote.
All right, you tell me about this quote.
Oh.
Okay, here we go. I observe this exchange like an alien collecting data about another planet. You describe two different worlds that coexist in the same space.
Yeah. So when we were living in public spaces, what I often felt and thought about was we were part of a different world, a different universe, a parallel universe. I would say today that we were unplugged from the Matrix. We were living in this space, but we knew it wasn't real. You know when you flip a coin, it's heads or tails, right? No, there's a third side. It's called equipoise. These things that we take for granted aren't always the full truth. And my family lived outside of heads or tails. We lived in a place of great fragility. And we would develop mechanisms and thoughts about how best to survive that day. And one of the things we would do, for instance, is you begged in the morning. Why? Because people hadn't had a bad day yet. And they are much more generous in the morning. These things, which are like, what? How do you take care of your bodily functions? I remember when I was 4 and I was begging one morning, and the crowd up ahead of me, about 4 feet, parted and then came back behind me. They never even looked at me. And I remember thinking, I am invisible. I was filthy. I had face sores from my ears to my eyes to my mouth. I don't even know what they were. I hadn't showered. I don't even know. And I was starving. And I'm certain I smelt. You know that Peanuts character with the cloud? They parted and they didn't even look at me. And I remember this was a packed concourse. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I am disgusting. No. I was 4. And that was every day. So I would observe these things that went on in the world, and I would realize so profoundly that we were not cared for. If we died that day, no one would have cared. No one. So I constantly felt sometimes like I was a stranger observing this other world. And honestly, sometimes I still do. Sometimes I still do.
I wonder, I mean, this is not in any of this, but I'm just going to, we're going to riff.
We're way off the rail, sister.
We're going to riff. First of all, I mean, unlike Los Angeles, where weather is, I mean, in New York, the surviving in the winters were you riding subways in order to survive? Were you, I mean.
Oh my gosh.
And was it you and your mother? I mean, how were these decisions made?
So my mom, so if you haven't read the memoir, shame on you. No, kidding. you will, and it's an amazing book. I've been told. In all seriousness, how do you survive? How you survive is moment to moment. And even in this paradise, there are incredible dangers in Los Angeles for homeless kids and families. There are too few beds for people with psychiatric issues. There's too few family shelters. There's too few services for women and children escaping domestic violence. We criminalize poverty, and then we crucify these people. When I was growing up, how we survived day to day depended on my mom. My mom had a bucket of mental health issues that were progressively worse. Our president, Reagan, said we were going to deal with mental health care in this country, and we deinstitutionalized and we shut down that system, but we never fulfilled the promise. And my mom fell through not a crack, but a giant Grand Canyon in our country, which is mental health care. So here's this woman suffering with these issues with three children, and everyone looked away. We have this problem. We look at an issue and we say, I can't because. That is what we all say. I say it. And the problem is the kids need us to not stop there. I can't because I'm poor, I'm tired, I have other issues, but I will do this. That's the revolution we need. We may not be able to lift up that homeless mom with three children sleeping on the subway. What can you do is the question we have to demand of ourselves. Most people in the city rail against our mayor around homelessness. She has part of the responsibility, but most people can't name their county supervisor. That is where the power and authority lies for this issue, mental health, probation, foster care, and homelessness. We are civically illiterate. We did not vote. We did not matter, and we had no power. The people, like my family, need us to stop being civically illiterate. Can you commit once a year to go to a meeting? Can you find out who all your people are and write them a damn letter? Do you know that one member of the LUSD school board has a kid in school? That doesn't disqualify anybody. But we should all know that. We march for equity, but we have a factory of failure, which is struggling because we keep cutting the funding, we build taller walls at our private schools, and then we're shocked when the public schools are failing. We can do better. What was your question?
No. I mean, right. You know, when we first met, because I'm just going to, you know, I'll look at some of these, but we talked about homelessness, and you were kind of extraordinary, because I remember turning to you and you said, well, let me just tell you what I would do. We were eating breakfast, and you were like, let me just tell you. And then, like, about 45 minutes later, but yeah.
That hand gesticulation is right on point. Many of my friends here would know that.
There are a lot of interesting questions here, and we'll ask you about Vassar, and we'll ask you about getting your book published, but let's talk about the question is, like, what would you do? You were homeless, you were in foster care, you understand what that means, you understand what it means to be ignored, what it means to be seen, what it means to sit on both sides. And and you're very clear and articulate about how you see this issue. And very few people in the position of any kind of power in this country have actually been homeless.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important to listen to you. I was wildly impressed. And I think it puts something in all of our minds, in the forefront of our minds, about what this issue means, and also, you know, steps to taking care of the issue at hand, which is complicated.
Gosh, I hope no one's going to yell at me.
Please don't yell.
I could chip away. I could almost address most of homelessness with one policy change that's free. Do you want to know what it is?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you for asking. There are roughly 800,000 housing units in Los Angeles that are rent stabilized. Roughly half of them are filled with wealthy people. So affordable housing was supposed to be preserved for people that need it. We have half filled that promise. We're preserving it as we should. What if every 2 years you had to submit your taxes? And if you're not poor, one of two things happen. You pay market rate. Or if you move, the landlord gets a one-time 10% increase, because right now it's 0 to 3%. They win, we win. All of a sudden, you have a couple hundred thousand housing units unstuck. And the reason that's important is it's not a one-time fix. That unlocks that mechanism. We zero out the HUD housing waiting list. We get people out of their cars. This is not the solution for people with really serious issues, right? There's not a panacea. But you're talking about tens of thousands of housing units. No construction, no traffic, no CEQA, no government money except for implementation costs. A third of the homeless in Los Angeles, Bakersfield, San Diego, all up and down the coast, a third are former foster kids between the ages of 16 and 24. A third. Over 50% of people in America that have experienced homelessness or are homeless were in foster care. We are emancipating kids to the street. And are we okay with that? What if we built a dorm at LA City College? What if we emancipated kids into a two-year vocational or transfer? We own the land, multiple kids per room. They get a skill. We have plenty of lawyers in the state of California. We don't have enough vocationally trained people. This is not a panacea, but there are real solutions. And we choose to throw up our hands. And the problem with that is ranting does not change anything. The gritty work that I did in the Planning Commission for 8 years, which I brought my homelessness experience to prioritize the linkage fee, the permanent supportive housing ordinance, the motel-hotel conversion ordinance, these may not mean anything to you, but they move the needle on homelessness in Los Angeles. The lived experience of people in the city is so important to bring to positions of power. There are 20-something elected people. Do you know how many commissioners are in Los Angeles? 300. Do any of you know one? How do you get appointed? Those are positions of power and influence. And I was a planning commissioner for almost 8 years. We need to be less civically illiterate. If we can figure out TikTok and our iPhone, we can figure this stuff out. I think we could choose to live in a different city, and Los Angeles truly could change the game. That's why I wrote this book. I want people to stop looking at these issues as intractable. I don't need your pity. My mom did not need your pity. The homeless people don't need your pity. They need your action. They need your action. We should not be okay with the condition of public schools as they are today. We're debating whether or not they should have art and music. What kind of, who are we? Who are we?
All right, we're
going to talk about the book. I'm sorry.
No. Well, this is part of the book, and it's part of why we're all here this evening. But I am going to get specific about you and what you're about. And
Scorpio?
And let's talk about your outfit just a little bit.
I'm wearing Sandro. And if someone wants to tag that, maybe he will give me a discount.
Because your journey is really interesting, and you did end up going to Vassar, and then on, holidays, Thanksgiving, yeah. Christmas, what this actually meant, how you looked, you were at a very privileged institution, yeah. How you looked at the other students. I mean, your trajectory and what went on and your just sense of yourself emotionally from where you came from. Yeah. And where you found that strength to sort of be able to really mediate and also deal in a very, very impressive and extraordinary way with sort of mastering the universe in this different tract. You know, I think because we're not given, if we're ignored,
yeah.
on the street and we're not given attention and we're not given an education and we're not given, and then to experience. Let's talk to people about how, what happened.
So I want to answer the question about that, but I want to take a step back for a moment because it's relevant to your question. When I went into foster care, I was about 12, and I placed this in foster care. Any foster alum here? Yay, yeah. When I went to foster care, it was a different epic. It was a different time. And when I recently, not so recently, recently enough, I got my file. And this is the age before the internet, so it was paper. And it was a lot of paper. You know those photocopy paper boxes? It's like six of those. Wow. Apparently I was complicated. That's a funny story, but like page three, they diagnosed me as gender identification disorder, GID. GID is used, at the time, was used to treat queer children. So I went in, and when you go into foster care, this is roughly still true, but it's slightly different today. You're given a number. You're given a rating. So the higher your rating, the more complicated your case is. It could be a disability. It could be behavioral issues. It could be whatever. And the higher your number, you have to match the foster home that's validated to take that kind of case. Well, I was a 10 automatically because I was queer, and they did not want to put us in general population. And most homes would not take us. So I was separated from my brother and sister, and I was put into a young adult offender facility where I did not belong. And I remember so specifically my social worker drove us in, and she paused before the first fence of barbed wire, and she said, "You do not belong here, and I will get you out." She didn't. And I went in there, and very quickly I decided, after my first very violent assault, which I talk about, that I would stop crying. I did not cry till I was 37, and I was at the Planning Commission, essentially, cried in front of people coming out because of the way people were talking about a shelter for women and children, and it just broke me, the language people use to describe homeless people. But it was a huge piece of my life that left me wrecked in many respects, but I always knew my way out was going to be education, even though I never went to school as a kid. I learned to read at libraries. I slept at libraries. I ate at libraries. I would not be here if it weren't for libraries. And I came in today a little early, and I definitely saw homeless people here. And I went into one of the bathrooms, and I was like, this is exactly where I used to bathe. Saved my life, and I'm honored to be here. When I got to college, I remember I applied to college, and I submitted a letter, and I said, I am not giving you the $65 check, because I don't have $65. And most of the institutions mailed me back my package. One college did not. And I went there, and it was my dream school. I went to Vassar. And when I got to Vassar, I thought, oh my gosh, my problems are solved. Boy, was I wrong. Vassar was an amazing institution, but they had never dealt with a person like me. And I don't mean my hair. I mean, my life was very complicated. So when the dorms closed for the first holiday break, I had nowhere to go, and I slept in my car again. Because I didn't know. I didn't know you're supposed to ask for help. And I remember the first time someone said, do you want to go get sushi? And I thought, what the fuck is sushi? But I also learned you got to say yes, because if you keep saying no, they're not going to invite you anymore. So I said yes, and we went to get sushi, and I was like, it's raw? Like, did you know that? Like, yeah, it's a thing. I'm like, you're paying money for raw seafood. They're like, yeah. I'm like, oh, wow, rich people. they're crazy. But there were so many moments like that, or even when I got to the book line, and I handed her my student ID that first year, and the very nice book lady said, no, honey, no. And I thought, are you fucking kidding me? I just got here. Which was impossible. I do not have $400. What am I going to do? I don't have supplies. I don't have lab fees. And the school wasn't bad. They just didn't know. So I had to keep dealing with these things of what the heck am I supposed to do? I had multiple jobs. I called it the hustle. I used to install wood floors. I worked at Friendly's, which is a minorly fancy Denny's. If you're familiar.
Good ice cream.
If I can even say that. I don't mean to offend Denny's. But I did what I had to do to survive. But over time, Vassar came to understand me. I got a job at the White House, and Vassar said, we'll give you a grant. So I worked at the White House because Vassar College stepped up and supported me. It is an institution that changed my life, and I changed it. They have a very robust program to help students like me now, and I'm very proud of that. But to jump back for a second on the queer issue, thank you. It's what I said earlier about homelessness. When I went into foster care, they diagnosed me as queer. Turns out they were right. Burst your bubble. Not straight. But they spent a lot of time trying to make me straight. That does not work. It's inhumane, and it's wrong. And it's fundamentally something that lit a fire in me. I remember I came out in different spheres of my life at different times, right? Queer kids, this is what we do. We find that safe space. We try to, you know, spread our wings a little bit. I started with a group called Lambda Legal. If you're not familiar, it's kind of a queer civil rights organization. And the Child Welfare League of America. And we started something called the Joint Initiative, which was an attempt and an effort, first, to stop reparative therapy in foster care and delinquency. And it took 13 years, but we did it. And it was because of those organizations, but it was because of kids like me in DC sitting at the table saying, you're killing us. You've got to stop this. 30% of kids in Los Angeles' foster care identify as queer. That's triple. Why? And do we have the right services in place? I know we have the right people that care, but do we have the right services? Do we have the right, we don't need your tolerance. We need to be raised as beautiful, full people. And I was proud to do that. And that's what I've tried to do with all of my experiences with my life, with homelessness and foster care, is they cannot have been for nothing.
But you're a foster parent, aren't you? I mean, you're a foster parent. I mean, to choose, that's a wonderful thing. I mean, you must feel...
I'm a little nervous. I hope there's tequila out there. That's how I'm feeling
now.
No,
I mean, I you must feel as a foster parent that you're repairing.
My foster son...
Yeah, I mean, you're repairing things that were not given or done for you.
I think he helped me more than I helped him. So my coping mechanism, and I always had this visual in my head, we all have, like, a lot coming at us all the time. In the moment, stuff we haven't dealt with, stuff we remember, other people's stuff. And it used to just kept coming at me, and I had to deal, you have to deal with it. And so what I would do is, because it would hurt, and I mean that, is I would try and find a way to deal with it. And my mental image, you know, these mental maps people have to have good memories? Mine was I would take the things that were assaulting me and I would put it in a clear plastic bin and I'd put it on a shelf. You had to be able to know it, but you didn't have to feel it because you needed to know it in order to survive when it came up again. But you didn't have to feel it. And my foster son, when I was 37, took a sledgehammer to my shelf. Not literally. Figuratively, right? It's a metaphor, you know, you go with me. I'm an author. What he did is he demanded that I start to cry again. He demanded vulnerability so that he could process his own grief and trauma. And he taught me that to be vulnerable is to be powerful. He taught me that in order for him to heal, adults, parents, society needs to not condemn emotion, but embrace it. And children, if we're smart enough, will teach us. And he tried for 13 years. It took a while. But eventually he did, and he is truly the love of my life. He's doing great. But I truly believe he helped me heal that last little bit that made me the person I am today that allowed me to write this.
Yeah, I was going to say, how does he feel about the book?
Oh, he's great. He's live streaming. Hello.
How does he feel about your story? There's a question here that I thought was kind of interesting. Not that these questions aren't interesting, but, you know, your book does deal with, obviously, homelessness and foster care and mental illness and, you know, the list goes on.
But it's good. It's a good list.
It's a good list and an important list. And You know, I guess, I mean, we sort of know that you're very involved in foster care and you're very vocal about homelessness. What about mental illness and your mother's mental illness and what's going on in this country with mental illness and how we don't acknowledge it? I mean, to me, there's education, as you're saying. Education. And then it's healthcare in this country, you know. And what about mental illness and how it's dealt with in the city?
And the county, I would take a step back from that, and I would say what I focus on is poverty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have these saplings, these little trees that we plant in this field, and we're like, why are they not thriving? And it's, how do we decrease the overrepresentation of men and boys of color in the system? How do we address teen pregnancy? How do we address mental health care? How do we, all these important and good issues. And there are these little saplings, and we plant them. The problem is no one's tending the whole field. That whole field is poverty. No matter what we do, if we do not address the systemic and root causes that are leading to these problems, if you are wealthy and crazy, you're eccentric. If you're poor, you're crazy. And we're going to criminalize you. Poverty. We will not have healthy children, which is my issue, if we don't have healthy families. We will not have healthy families if communities have nothing but a richness of fear, a paucity of opportunity, poor housing, a crappy physical environment. Have you driven around? The built environment determines what I call self-efficacy, the belief that you matter. What is our physical? Our schools look like prisons. Do any of you drive by those concrete block buildings and you're like, is this a prison? Why don't we build temples to education anymore? There's three high schools in Los Angeles that are always filmed, right, for those movies? They're beautiful. Why are we building prisons? What are we doing? We are teaching children what they mean to us as a society. We have to address poverty. All of these things will come out of that, in my opinion. That's why I focus my advocacy on poverty. I specifically focus on foster care, not only because it's important to me. I spent more time homeless than I did in foster care. Why I focus on foster care is the following. There are roughly 700,000 children in America that come into the system each year. About 400 to 450 stay. What if one of two things happened? What if the two-thirds of the kids coming into the system that are there for neglect, two-thirds of those kids, hundreds of thousands are there for neglect. Do you know what neglect is a euphemism for? Damn right. It is a euphemism for poverty. Do you know what poverty in our country is a euphemism for? Racism. We are criminalizing poor people of color. We're taking their children, we're grinding them up, and then we put them out and we're like, why are they not succeeding? Why are their families destroyed? Why don't they fix it themselves? We need to decriminalize poverty. We need to help these families, and don't jump at me. But do you know who signed the most important law on this issue? Donald Trump. Bear Hart, this could be a bipartisan issue, written by someone who was here a few minutes ago. When she was in Congress. For the first time ever, the federal government is letting states use federal money to preserve and support families. It used to be you only got reimbursed as a state if you took the kid away. That was the law for 50 years because we're all asleep. That changed because of her. And him. That's fine. Let's embrace the good. Today, we're starting to implement that across the country. States can opt in to do that. You can imagine what states aren't. But we are. We are. Why is that important? If we can decrease the pressure on the system and just have it for kids that have to come in, and we stop destroying families with intergenerational violence that's state sanctioned, we can have a system that works. But we need two other things, and I'll stop this. Non-answer.
Okay.
One, we need foster parents. Why don't people foster? Most middle-class people don't foster because of pension, their retirement, their kids' college, and healthcare. With great love and respect for people that are doing it today, do not condemn them. Stop asking why they do it unless you do it. You don't have a right. Thank them for opening their home. But more people would do it. What if we made them postal workers for benefits? All of a sudden, you remove the biggest financial issues for a huge swath of society. we don't need a million, we need a couple thousand. You could remove the biggest barrier to those folks. Why does that matter? Because then you have a lot more people in the system that takes the pressure off. What about social workers? My sister was a social worker. She couldn't afford to live within 30 miles of where she worked in Los Angeles. What if we gave social workers, after 5 years of good service, interest-free home loans? We could do it. Who are we waiting for, y'all? All of a sudden, my sister, who once told me, I said, what do you do for a living? She said, paperwork. And I said, what next? She goes, I am basically Airbnb. I'm calling, trying to find a placement. Calling and trying to find a placement. Calling. This is a licensed, trained, therapeutic social worker. And we have her doing paperwork. What if we took the pressure off that system? What if we supported these mostly women of color who are doing this work? They are on the front line of poverty, the war on poverty. We treat our veterans as heroes, which we should. So are these people. They are fighting a fight that we forgot that we were engaged in. And we need to lift them up, recognize them, and support them. And we can. We don't have to wait for DC. We could do this tomorrow, LA.
Do you know that the library has
social workers?
Oh, I love
this, Jessica. Tell me more.
We have a social worker, and we are hiring more social workers to deal with, since we are at the front line of what's going on in this city.
That's right.
And I wish I had a list that I could, with these cards, tell you all the things that we are able to give the public, and that people really don't know, that all the things that the library has to offer people. Who are homeless, and you know, our doors are open to everyone, obviously, as you saw.
That's
I want to ask you about the quote.
Oh,
there's a couple of things I want to ask you. I know
we're going to come for questions,
and then we're going to have some questions. There is a quote in the front of this book, and I know it's an important quote for you, and I know you know it's. It's made its way into your life permanently on your body.
Wow, that's intimate, Jessica.
So would you talk about this?
You weren't supposed to tell people about
quote?
That.
I'm going to say the Latin.
Wait, you want to see it?
Illegitimi non carborundum.
Illegitimi non carborundum. Raise your hand if you know you've heard of that. Okay, I love you, Margaret Atwood fans. So I was in one of the delinquency facilities, I don't remember which one, and it was very bad. And I was being isolated because I did not suffer sufficiently as a supplicant. And I was in a room by myself, and it was no furniture, and it was a pretty crappy room. But there was a bookshelf, and it had some tattered books on it, most of which were just like torn up and parts were missing. So I picked up this chunk of pages, and I started reading, and it was The Handmaid's Tale. And I didn't read the whole book because it wasn't there, which is typical of my life at that point. But I read it, and I'm not offered, but like I was really empathizing with what she was going through in that book. And I remember if you remember the book, she reads that quote, carpenter mm-hmm. furniture, illegitimi non carborundum, which is a pseudo-historical phrase that means don't let the bastards grind you down. Bastards are not people only, they're systems. And I decided then and there that's my life's motto. And it took me years later to figure out what the hell that book was and finish it. But illegitimi non carborundum is why I refuse to give in to what we live in today. It has never been better, but we can make it a paradise. We can make that choice, and I refuse to give in because it's hard, and none of us can, especially for children, because they don't vote, they don't have power. And so that's the motto that's tattooed across my body in a very respectable place.
Okay, I'm just going to ask one more question that's very general to you before we answer a few audience questions. Since you've written this book, you've been on GMA, because I remember, you know, this is somebody who is, you do not give up. And it's an extraordinary thing about you. You're like, I'm going to have this happen. And like 2 weeks later, it happened. So since this book, what's happened in terms of just how people view you, how you view yourself, how you move through the world? I mean, you've told your story. And that's a big thing to
do.
That's
on the pre-approved list. I got a little distracted, so I first want to say thank you to you and the entire library staff for doing this. This is an incredible honor for me to be at this institution in a place that I grew up in, basically, back on the East Coast.
So it's an honor to have you
here. I wanted to say thank you. I meant to do that earlier. What's it been like? Earth-shattering. You know, even when I was writing it, I sent copies to my brother and sister. So my brother and sister, we were separated for the most part, and I didn't see them very much for a while. We're very close today, but my brother and sister, and I had never shared this with them, any of it, really, other than the early part of our life together. And my brother helped me remember stuff that I had chosen to forget, it turns out. And it brought I heard about his stories. He fought overseas. He got out of foster care, became essentially homeless, and then ended up joining the military to survive. And he served honorably. And it brought us together, and it helped us share. So in my most intimate settings, it has been a vital tool for me. It has clarified something for me. I've always felt really blessed and privileged. I believe that most people are sleepwalking through life. We're anesthetized. We're just like getting through the day, and we don't remember 2 days ago. And what I feel so blessed in my life that's been crystallized by this whole project has been how determined I am and how my life really is this mission. And it has crystallized that for me, and it's given me a platform. Like, no one wanted to come hear me talk 2 years ago before I wrote the book. Well, a few of you. But this has given me an excuse, a platform, and a privilege to be a voice for my people. And I recognize the privilege of that, and I'm trying to use it accordingly. And I'm very lucky. You know, I have a job that allows me to do this, a company that allows me to do this. And I sometimes feel like Forrest Gump meets Hillbilly Elegy with a little bit of Precious. Here's why. I mean, read the book.
They'll read the book, but tell us why.
What an impossible life. Remember Forrest Gump? He does all these things. He ends up in weird rooms. You're like, what? That's often how I feel. Hillary Clinton blurbed my book because I accidentally got an internship that Vassar gave me money for because I met the chief of staff for the head of the Democratic Party, whose mom was an office worker at Vassar, who I talked to, who helped me get my financial aid in order. Alice O'Keefe, if you're watching, and Peter, thank you. That's what I mean. And I say Hillbilly Elegy before he became a right-wing nut job, because if you read his beautiful memoir, it truly was pulling back the lens on a whole people that we write off, which is folks that are in Appalachia that are poor, that we don't understand and we're really grumpy at. And it's not that we agree with them or don't agree with them, but for me, it taught me more empathy than I had before I read it. And Precious, because if you've read that beautiful book or watched that really hard film, that was my life in some respects. And the beauty of that book, if you've read that book, it is, oh. So I feel like I've had this weird, weird experience that has led me to be able to write a book, to have the connections to go on Good Morning America, to reach out to my friend who's on the board of this organization, the Library Foundation, and say, hey, I'd like to do this. And here I am. What an impossible life I've led. And so that's what I mean by that, is I've had this incredible life. I live a life of purpose and privilege, and I'm going to use the hell out of it to lift up my people that are still struggling.
Is it also a catharsis of sorts?
Absolutely.
I mean, I would imagine
it's
not
awkward
only...
for dating. It's yeah. awkward for dating.
Yeah.
I will not lie. People Google that. They're like, oh, boy. not sure I want to get in on that. But I figure that filters out the losers. So... And I'm still looking. This is on Instagram Live. my Instagram is HJB Ambrose. My age range is 35 to 52. Just have your shit together.
I'm going to just ask two questions since we're getting, you know.
Long in the tooth. I'm sorry.
Unless
there's a reception,
there,
y'all.
Would you, because I'll take questions from the audience. Would
I'll you, repeat them, or we have a microphone here.
We have a microphone, and this lovely man was very anxious and excited to be here and was trying to help with the protests. So thank you.
So, is my ringing or no? It's not on? Okay, now it is. Cool. So, David, one, thank you, man. I really appreciate you. I am a former foster youth, as you know, and I appreciate you, bro. Like, really, from the bottom of my heart, I thank you. Like, you are helping so many people, whether you realize it or not. We're connected on so many levels, whether, like, well, one of our friends are connected together. Another friend that I want to talk about and highlight that I want to connect with the library is One Simple Wish, right? So it's going to be one of my partners of my business, and one, I'm going to be helping enable their organization. One, they're already doing fucking amazing. They give 15 to 15,000 foster youth each year, right? They just simple wishes like, hey, I want a pair of Jordans, whatever, right? They're, which is a friend of David's as well. She's freaking amazing.
It's like Make-A-Wish or Toys for Tots.
Exactly.
But it focuses on foster youth, and it focuses on all ages, and it's an amazing organization. And it's linked off of my website, davidambrose.com, yes, as are other great opportunities to give back. So yes, thank you for bringing up One Simple yes Wish.
So I was thinking about what my wish would be, right? And as a former foster youth, I get to ask a wish, but I'm kind of extra a little bit, just, you know. And I thought about my daughter, right? And I have a daughter, and I've worked my ass off to get to where I'm at, and I luckily get to say I spend $1,600 a month on my daughter's Montessori school, right? And she's 2.5, right? And I am so happy to watch her grow and be so self-sufficient. Like, it is, being a dad has been such a beautiful moment, and being able to, one, heal myself to be able to even have a child, but to see, be able to provide for a child that, and see how much is growing. My wish is that other former foster youth or foster youth get to be able to go through Montessori school. How do you ever do you ever see a world that other foster youth could have Montessori growing up, like to become self-sufficient? My daughter is two and a half years old. She counts over 30. She knows her ABCs. Do you see a world like that?
So first of all, love you. I'm going to repeat a little bit of the question, which is, he is a foster alum or survivor and has a two-year-old daughter that's in Montessori school, which is a type of private school that is very progressive and smart and intelligent and embraces the human more than the test, is how I would describe it. So I'm going to say something a little radical. Are you guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't we ban private and non-public schools? Watch how quickly the public schools get fixed. That may not be possible. And I don't know if I actually think that. But what I want us to do is think that way. I don't know that the solution, when the boat is sinking and the lifeboat is not big enough for everybody, I worry. I'm glad your daughter's in Montessori school. What I want to figure out, yes, I want to help foster kids get to these amazing access these amazing privileged things. But what I also want us to do is say, how do we reinvest in the public space? And the thought experiment for a second, right? When I said that, did all of you clench a little bit? Did you see people coming at me with pitchforks? I just lost my city council campaign. But we need to think that way, not to do it, but to see how aggrieved we be, because the schools are fill in the blank. So yes, I want to give young people that privilege coming out of foster care, because we deserve it as well. But I also focus my efforts on how do we fix this ship of state, because we can choose to make these schools paradises. I truly believe that.
Oh, no, there's a right behind you, yeah.
Okay, I'll make this quick. I have a friend, single male, gay, trying to
tell me more.
foster, and the system
plot
does not,
twist,
and the system is not letting him go through with that.
Go through with what? Say it again, I interrupted you.
Fostering. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's had a problem for like 8 years trying.
Well, let's talk outside. I could definitely connect. You know, I'm not the Google of it all, but I can definitely help you connect to resources, and that's part of what I want to do. Are you coming to the reception? Okay, I'll be there.
Oh, this woman right here, yeah.
Hi. My name is Foxy O, and I'm here. I'm a former Skid Row resident, and Skid Row is a homelessness capital of the world. But I'm here with my colleagues. We're from the Urban Voices Project. We were invited. It's a major music project that we're on, and I'm wondering if you are interested, if it's appropriate to ask if you're willing to donate books to us, A Place Called Home. We finished one of our major productions. It's called A Place Called Home. We would like to invite you also.
That. Now, you said, first of all, yes. Be glad to. And I'm sure people here will help me make that a promise a reality. So let's connect. I'll be at the reception. But I'd be honored. And you don't get what you don't ask for. You know what I always say is the only bad ask is the ask not asked. Thank you. And that's a great title, by the way.
Two more questions? How's that sound? Oh, yeah.
We got to geographically disperse it here.
Thank you. First of all, let me just say I'm impressed. I haven't read your book. I'll tell you, I came to see the mayor, but I will buy your book. But I'm just impressed by your story, and I want to ask if the reception, how did you get out if you said you were in homelessness to the age of 12? How did, and your sister also got out, so there's something there. I'm a social worker by training. I was a professor at Cal State Northridge, where I taught for 25 years, trained social workers. And so I'm just so pleased that your sister is a social worker. You talked about funding. When I went to Northridge in 94, the state gave 65%, and the public gave 35%. When I left 6 years ago, the state was giving 35%. And the public was responsible for 65%. So you ask about that disparity in education. I also had the opportunity to serve on the LA County Mental Health Commission for 6.5 years. And one of the things that I always found is that if you look at the population of Los Angeles County and the state of California, state of California has roughly about 40 million people. 5% of that population is of African American descent. And the same numbers are the same about LA County and LA City. But if you look at the criminal justice system, you look at mental health, you look at poverty, who's the numbers? On Skid Row, the lady said roughly about 45 to 55% of the people on Skid Row of African American descent. And so I'd like an honest response from you. Why do you think if the population is so low in the state, in the county, in the city, why do we have a significant number of African Americans who are homeless in the criminal justice system and in mental health?
Yeah.
If you don't mind.
I'm gonna answer the last one and then answer the first one. So systemic and criminalized racism, and we've criminalized poverty. It's what I said earlier, which is when you hypervigilize a community and take away their children because they struggle, and then you put them in a system that is underfunded, under-resourced, and under incredible duress, and then you put them through public educational systems that are consistently being decreased in funding and overtaxed with more and more responsibilities, what do we expect? I came through a system that was disproportionately people of color, but there I was, and I saw firsthand what that system did to me, and yet I have the privilege of being a cisgendered white man in America, and here I sit talking to you. So I think it's what I said, which is when we criminalize poverty, we're really talking about racism, and we have to address that. One thing I get asked quite often on this book tour has been some version of like, well, if you made it, pull yourself by your bootstraps, you know, that kind of question. I reject that, not because mm-hmm. people are bad for asking it. We should never put a child through what I went through to get to where I got to. We should design a system that is robust enough for any child to reach their full potential. The only way that you're going to do that, sir, and everybody, is to really reinvest in the communities and the families. If you want that kid to thrive, we have to stop doing what we're doing, which is tearing up communities or underinvesting in them. There's a wonderful book, I wish it was an African-American female writer, who talked about when we integrated the pools, we filled the pools. Does anyone know her name?
Heather McGee.
I just finished the book, and I'm ashamed I didn't remember her name. I had never even thought of that. But basically, once we started bringing everyone into the public space got really crappy. Yeah. We started defunding higher educational institutions when they were opened up, right? We don't have to live like that. We can make a choice. Voting once every couple years will not keep this a democracy or a republic. You have to get engaged. You have to show up. You know, I did not like what happened here. I didn't. I respect it. I didn't like it. That is one type of engagement. Good on them for showing up. When is the last time all of us went to a county supervisor meeting or our school board or anything other than to complain? Do you know that more than 70-something percent of the land in Los Angeles is zoned for single family?
Oh, I didn't know that, yeah.
What do we think's going to happen with affordability? What do you think's going to happen? And yet, a lot of us probably live in those. I used to. So I think showing up and asking these questions is vital, and I hope I've addressed your question a little bit, and I'd love to talk to you more about your service on mental health in particular. One final one do you want to do? And then
yeah,
we'll
let's do one final, tequila. Then we'll all go to the reception, and David will talk to...
No one. I'll listen.
Then we'll eat some very good cheese. And have a cookie or two.
First of all, I have tons of people to fix you up with.
Hey!
Second of all, the book was so important and beautiful, and I wonder if you would close the night reading a passage or just some of the first few pages for the people who have not
read
it.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Thank you for that.
I did not plant that.
It should be on.
I have a very, it is, give me one second. There it is. I'm not gonna tell you, you're gonna have to listen. This is us at Vassar College's graduation, where Tony Kushner, the amazing playwright who wrote Homebody Kabul and Angels in America, was delivering the graduation speech. And at first I was like, who is this guy? Why did we not get Oprah? Isn't that what everyone asks at college? I watch in awe. In a fast-paced staccato, Tony Kushner delivers an hour-long riveting commencement address in 30 minutes. He urges us to be aware and honest agents of change. He implores us to organize, to be political, and to claim power, redistribute it, and legislate it into justice. His words converge with everything I've been thinking and working toward and fighting for to this point in my life. This is exactly what I am going to do. This is my plan, I decide. And what can drive us forward in a world that is full of people who are determined, it seems, to bring it to an end? He answers his own question. Hope. Hope isn't a choice. It's a moral obligation, a human obligation, an obligation to the cells in your very body. Hope is a function of those cells. It is a bodily function, the same as breathing, eating, and sleeping. It is hope that has made me brave, hope that has kept me clawing for the surface when I was drowning, hungry, bruised, torn down, and almost erased. Hope that has preserved my fight and my identity and my soul. Relentless, insanely impossible hope that has gotten me to this chair, on this hillside, on this day, with this black gown and rather awkward cap. My full family behind me and around me. I will drive west to Los Angeles, infused with that spirit and that determination. I am finally my whole self.
I think you give us hope. We'll see you all at the reception outside. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.